You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 26th of January 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One here at Midori House in London with me, Emma Nelson and Dominic Reynolds.
Coming up on today's programme, we review the new exhibition in London showing the portraiture of Manet at the Royal Academy.
And this week's music guest will be the man responsible, among other things, for this.
Of course, we're talking about Peter Fredriksson from Sweden's Quiet Nights Orchestra. We're also going to be talking multiplex romance. It all started in a cafe in the 80s.
Yes! 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 Oh! Oh! Oh!
We'll be asking if the rom-com has lost its afterglow. So lots to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24.
Now, about a mile away from where we're sitting in Midori House in London right now, one can only imagine the length of the queue gathering outside the Royal Academy. It's the opening day of a major exhibition of the portraiture of the 19th century artist Edouard Manet, and it's had a huge billing. Described by the show's curator as the founder of modern art, Manet's been the subject of several high-profile retrospectives, but this is the first time his portraits have taken centre stage.
To discuss this further, I'm delighted to say we're joined in the studio by regular Monocle contributor and friend of the programme, Peter York, and also joining us from Norwich is Rachel Campbell-Johnston, art critic for the Times newspaper. Welcome to you both to today's review. Rachel, if we may start with you, what was your first impression of the Manet exhibition?
Well, it's such an amazing show to have because if you think about these paintings, they are the crux of their collections that they're in all over the world, and people don't want to lend them because if you're talking about the change from grand academic traditions to modernism, Manet is the bridge. So it is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together, and it's incredibly ambitious and fantastic that the Royal Academy's got it.
To what degree do you think, this is an unusual opportunity? I mean, we've said there have been two major Manet exhibitions in the last 10 years, one at the Prado, one at the Musée d'Orsay. How is this one different and what are the opportunities here?
Well, what this show does is it purports to focus on his portraits. I mean, on his death, Manet left something like 430 oil paintings, for the sake of argument, about half of which were portraits or genre works with strong portrait elements. And this is the first show which makes this portraiture the focus. It's slightly misleading in that you could argue that pretty much every picture Manet does with people in it is a portrait. But it's looking at the society, very emphatically, at the society in which Manet lived. This is taking the spectator back to the days when Paris, under the supervision of Baron Haussmann, was undergoing that total overhaul that would transform it from a fundamentally medieval city to a sort of bravura stage set, perhaps, on which Baudelaire's Vie Moderne could be strutted. And here we are taken into the soiree. Here we are meeting his friends and his family, the radical politicians, the great writers of the day. So it's like really being at a party, at a very haute bourgeois party in Manet's era. And that's very much the mood of the show. It introduces you to these people group by group rather than arranging itself in a chronological way.
Peter, were you captivated by this party mood?
Well, I'm all on for haute bourgeois parties, and I go to a lot of them, and I didn't get enough of it from this exhibition, which seemed sort of billed as a blockbuster, but seemed rather thin. It was literally sort of thinly hung and rather oddly hung, and I wanted to be told, as a pleb, what Manet's claims were for being king of the modern world and the Great Bridge, and I didn't think I got it.
Do you think there was a bit too much presumed knowledge here?
There was certainly too much presumed knowledge, and that wonderful bit of curator speak, unresolved. Unresolved means not finished.
But, I mean, perhaps this is one for Rachel. Is there something in that unresolvedness? I mean, is there a lesson to be learnt in the fact that we see bare canvas in this exhibition?
Well, in that case, you know, the trouble with Manet is he didn't actually need to earn a living as a painter, unlike many of his peers. Mm-hmm. So he was always abandoning works. Mm-hmm. And he also didn't work to commission. So he didn't have some dowager duchess breathing hotly down his neck saying, "Where's my picture?" So he did leave an awful lot of work unfinished. Where I totally disagree with Peter is the hang. It was a very sparse hang, but I think that the gallery learned its last great sort of blockbusting show was Van Gogh, and it was absolutely miserable experience to go there. You couldn't get near the works. And I think they very willfully decided to hang it sparsely so that they could dissolve the masses on the way. There was one room dedicated just to Baudelaire's Map of Paris. There was another in which just one painting was hung. And I think that was to disperse the crowds, because I don't know when Peter saw it, but maybe he, like me, had the great pleasure of going in on his own. But if you were there with the crowds, it's absolutely revolting if they're too closely hung. So I thought that was one strong mark for the Royal Academy. I think it had learned a lesson from its last show. Also, I don't know if Peter saw, they had a very, I thought it was perfectly well explained, their little blocks of text at the beginning of each room, that it explained it perfectly well. And I'm all for not having great blocks of text amongst the paintings, because that just distracts people. But having said that, Manet is a difficult painter, and Manet is a difficult painter because you can't say, "Oh, that's Manet, I recognise his style." He changes it the whole time. I mean, the great thing that he does is he breaks not only with the traditions of paintings before him, but with his own sort of mini tradition in every painting he starts. So at one moment you'll find him looking at Velasquez, for the sake of argument, and looking at his sort of swashbuckling brushwork and painting in dark tones and trying to conjure this sense of the old masters of the Spanish past. And the next moment he's painting what's a portrait of Monet and his family, and he's coming in the guise of the godfather of Impressionism. There's all that sort of pointillist dabs and bright colour dancing about. So yes, Manet does make you work extremely hard. That's what makes me love the show, and that's what makes me love him.
I was one of the people who went on the opening morning for when the Royal Academy members were allowed to go in, so I had to do it with the crowds. And I had quite a hard time going around that exhibition. I found the first room wonderful. I thought it delightful, intimate, surprising, a really beautiful snapshot of family life of Manet. But then you suddenly were catapulted into this very, very strange room where you just had music in the Tuileries, and you stood behind you going, "What else is in this room? Why are we all crowded round this one reasonably small picture?" And then you put into another room which gives you an attempt at a social portrait of what life in Paris was like at the time. It sort of sets you up, but when you're elbowing your way through the Royal Academy devotees, it can be very hard to see those little blocks by the pictures. And then by the time you've gone into the big area where all the social and artistic portraits come, you've kind of lost your way a little bit. Peter, what would you say to that?
I felt very much like that. The deserted room, which only had Tuileries Gardens, I thought, well, they've taken it all down. They've had an accident.
I wondered if they were waiting for one to arrive, because there were reports that the snow had delayed some of the pictures coming. It was an almost room.
I mean, you can't have an exhibition devoted to crowd management. You have people on police horses and kettling or whatever. And at the end of the day, I didn't get the lesson I thought this was going to teach me. And I assiduously read all those great big blocks at the beginning. And I thought, oh, this is wonderful. And then I thought, oh, this is not so wonderful. And then I thought, this is a dud. Why is it here? So, and then I thought, where are the ones I've seen on postcards?
I must confess, I was waiting for Olympia to whip her clothes off around the corner in the last room.
Olympia
I was waiting.
Never
for...
lent.
She never moves.
Olympia is never, ever lent.
No, she and Dejeuner Celebs are stuck.
She's absolutely stuck.
unless I'm going by, Maximilian wasn't there. Mm-hmm. And the Folie Bergère girl wasn't there. Sure. And these are the familiar, and the Maximilian one is the disturbing one, like a picture of, I don't know, David Cameron being mugged or something. It's sort of it's a different jarring, exciting note.
I mean, what you seem to be suggesting is that it's almost a victim of its own sort of claim, sort of didactic claims it makes at the beginning, that it sets out a thesis and it's very clear about what it's going to teach you. So you felt, Peter, that you didn't learn enough.
Well, I think there are three things. One, blockbuster. Wonderful things there, but not a blockbuster. Two, that you're going to get somehow, you're going to get the claim that he was the master of modernity, the Great Bridge, validated. And I didn't think I'd been taught that thing. And then the rather curious experience of everything about it. And I didn't... the thing about milieu, there are better, cleverer ways of now, with new technologies, of presenting milieu and making... all the names were fantastic, and my teenage me would have been very impressed with all those names, because my teenage self liked all the idea of Paris then. I've forgotten about it now. It's not the thing, is it? And they could have made... And the Houseman thing, and all those, that turbulence and the siege and fantastic stuff, you could have conjured it up better.
Rachel, let's bring you back in now to discuss the idea of this milieu that Peter was just talking about there. One thing that astonished me at the entrance of the portrait room, which made the portrait rooms marginally more successful for me, were the photographs that you get, the carte de visite and the daguerreotype, which explained a little bit more about why Manet was so revolutionary in the way that he approached portraiture.
Well... yes, I mean, I have to say, I found the photographs rather distracting, other than as a footnote, and I was quite glad that they were displayed almost like footnotes on the side. What they were saying is that although Manet had this idea that he painted people as if from life, as if they were still moving, as if, you know, he was sort of the first person to get out his sort of, I don't know, metaphorical iPhone and take the snap. So there was that sense, and the portraiture brought that out, and although Manet actually claimed that he would do his sitters in one sitting, that was... blatantly not true. And I think the only person he did clearly seems to have used a carte de visite portrait to do it. But what I completely disagree with Peter on is the sense that you're pushed into an argument. I mean, I strongly got the argument from this show that he was not necessarily the first modernist. He was the last of the masters of a grand academic tradition. That was something that the Royal Academy didn't push, but that seemed to me very, very clear. And the idea that we've lost all these, or that there aren't all the paintings you recognise, I cannot stress how galleries cling on to their Manets. But also we had some incredible ones. You know, the Musée d'Orsay lent four of them, I think, you know, those beautiful Berthe Morisot, which they're using as the poster, and Mallarmé in sort of Lost in Reverie, and Madame Manet at her piano. And then, you know, we didn't have Olympia, but we did have all these extraordinary gathering of other portraits of the same sitter, his great model, all gathered in one room at the end, and you could see how he takes one figure and turns her into different characters and casts her in this contemporary life that he wants to capture. So I think we're fishing for unfair criticisms on this. And as for the idea of the milieu and the conjuring of the Paris of the era, I mean, there's got to be a line drawn in an art gallery between a sort of all singing, all dancing, flashing lights spectacular, which conjures the era as a sort of, I don't know, like some sort of hallucinogenic thing, and actually just looking at the painting, because at the core of this is Manet and the way he painted and the time to look at the paintings. So to take two paintings together, to take the one I mentioned, Berthe Morisot with her bouquet of violets, and another portrait of her, which he does nearby, both of her, small pictures of her in black, could have been painted by two different people. It's a fantastic contrast. And it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas, because Manet is a man who lets paint think for itself. You feel paint having a life of its own. And that, in the end, is the most important thing, or for me, is the most important thing about any art exhibition. So really all that stuff about, you know, Manet's Paris and conjuring an idea of it and putting up hallucinogenic pictures of it, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. If you get the chance to stand in front of five paintings for 10 minutes each, that to me is a fantastic experience.
That's the sort of thing I like, a bit of conjuring of milieu. And you're right about the Morisot. That's fantastic. It should have been bigger or smaller, because you could have had a little exhibition about his, I don't know, obsession with his sister-in-law or not. Those things are fantastic, and the range of them, and the happy one and the mourning one and the big white dress one are completely fantastic and wonderful and would have been an exhibition on their own. And maybe you could have made the case just with that.
Well, there were exhibitions within exhibitions in this show. I mean, for instance, in that room, there are hung all his... He's a master of black. You know, people always talk about him as the first since the Venetians or since Titian to really get the richness and texture of the many shades of black, to turn black into a colour, to turn black into lightness. And there was one room hung just with black or white paintings. It was an amazing little mini show. I mean, what you didn't like, which is having music in the Tuileries on its own. I mean, they were asking us to look at this painting, and there's always the catalogue. I mean, Manet is very complicated. There are whole arguments, you know, there's a whole... In one of the great, great loans which they had, which is the Luncheon, which is almost never lent from Munich, you know, that painting is a sort of key. It could be, you know, it's a picture of Manet's son or adopted son, his wife's son, and no one knows who the father...
That was
or
one...
brother, or son of his, or son of his father, I was about to go on to say. No one knows who it is. You know, and it was it's a sort of family portrait he might have painted if he was going to be honest, but the figures remain shadowy. You know, there's that one painting. Even that on its own is a sort of entire detective story.
There is a very lovely whole room devoted to the relationship with Manet and his wife, and also this character Léon, who is like either brother, son, adopted son. And there are some beautiful pictures, not only of the Luncheon, but one that I was particularly struck by, which is Léon on a bicycle, which was just a delightful, intimate portrait of family life. What were your highlights, Peter, of the exhibition?
Well, I loved the Luncheon. That's fantastic, and that's got a claim to be special and bridgy and high impact. And what I did, I know what I didn't like. I didn't like all those sort of secondary blobby pictures of Suzanne Manet. I could have done without those. And I wanted it reduced or blown up. But the real highlight to me was Morisot in her various forms and the Luncheon.
Is there something to be said here about the billing of the blockbuster exhibition and the fact that plenty of people you've both sort of suggested, might be disappointed not to see certain pieces there? And given the sort of incredible end of 2011 and 2012 we've had, is there a sense that this might be to some degree underwhelming? There isn't really enough to justify this enormous billing. Rachel?
I completely disagree. I mean, I think three Manet paintings are enough. I suppose I'm slightly agreeing with Peter there, says it could be shrunk. But there's so many people. If they all get three each, that's great. But I mean, I know, I think it was a great show. The word blockbuster, I mean, it's a hideous word and it's bandied around, including by me. And it's done an awful lot of damage to art, but at the same time, it whips up excitement and interest, which has done an awful lot of good for art. So I think we're in a catch-22 with that one.
Rachel, what was your personal highlight?
I'm afraid Morisot, the Luncheon, and the beautiful portraits of his sort of thinker friends, that the fantastic one of Mallarmé, are completely lost in this moment of intellectual reverie. Or the railway, those sort of... It shows a girl sitting there and he catches them... sort of as they look up in that second before they catch your stare, when they're still lost in their own worlds. And any moment now they're about to look up and see you looking, and then that whole spell will be broken, that you will be a conscious onlooker and they will change their faces and their postures in a public way. It's that whole thing. But I mean, I would say there were 20 at least superlative paintings.
Rachel Campbell-Johnson from The Times and Peter York, thank you as ever for joining us here on The Review. Manet Portraying Life will be on at the Royal Academy in Piccadilly in London until the 14th of April 2013. Up next, we're getting our cultural look ahead for the weekend from Nelly Gocheva.
The Menu is Monocle 24's weekly look at good food, great drinks and the makers behind these experiences. Each week we serve up the latest in cuisine around the world, from top chefs to tiny breweries and, of course, the best baristas.
Coffees that really stand out, that jump off the table, is what we're always looking for.
On the latest edition we find out about the merits of urban beekeeping in Berlin. We visit an area of Seoul that has shaken its criminal reputation to become a hotspot for international restaurants. And we talk about a new trend which has people pairing their hot dogs with a glass of champagne.
champagne goes very well with fatty food because the acidity of champagne cuts through the fat content and it's extremely satisfying.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Emma Nelson. Time now to cross to Associate Editor Nelly Gorcheva to hear some cultural traits she's dug out from around the world for us this weekend.
If in London this weekend, head over to the Institute of Contemporary Arts for the opening of Jürgen Teller's exhibition, Woo. Famed for his provocative celebrity portraits, this retrospective also explores a more personal side to the German photographer. On display alongside commercial photography are intimate portraits of longtime collaborators like singer Björk and Teller's relatives. Woo is on until the 17th of March. The 42nd International Film Festival in Rotterdam kicked off earlier this week with a focus on independent international cinema and fresh talent. Highlights of the opening weekend include Jean-Charles Fétus's L'Inclus du Temps and Longing for the Rain by Chinese filmmaker Yang Lina. The festival is on until the 3rd of February. For more details, go to filmfestivalrotterdam.com. Now in its 18th edition, the LA Art Show returns this weekend with exhibitors from across the United States and the world. With galleries from Russia, Venezuela, China, and Korea, the show welcomes a diverse range of artists. A definite must-see is China Fusion exhibit, showcasing emerging artists from the country. Other highlights during the weekend include the Letters from Los Angeles exhibit and a painting session with West Hollywood-based painter David Whaley. LA Art Show closes on Sunday. For more information, go to laartshow.com. In Tokyo, D47 Museum is showcasing a hand-picked selection of the latest winners of the Good Design Award, a prize distinguishing innovative Japanese products since 1957. This weekend is your last chance to visit the exhibition located in Tokyo's busy Shibuya district. Dedicated to promoting goods from all over the country, D47 have chosen between 3 to 8 items to represent each of Japan's 47 prefectures. Some of the 230 products on display are also available for purchase. And finally on our soundtrack this weekend is Home, the second album by LA producer Jason Chung, also known as No Such Thing. Let's hear Eclipse Blue. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gorcheva.
And that was Eclipse Blue by Jason Chung, otherwise known as No Such Thing, ending that report there from Nelly Gorcheva. Jason Chung's new album, Home, is out now.
It's time now for our weekly music review, and today we cross to Stockholm to see our guest, Peter Fredriksson, a man who, if you dust very carefully, you will find his musical fingerprints all over Monocle 24, and he has had those there since the day we launched in October 2011.
Peter is the leader of the 8-piece Swedish jazz band Quiet Nights Orchestra, known for their blend of retro soul, funk and jazz, coupled with some up-to-date production techniques, and in Midori House are also known as the architects of the Monocle 24 theme sound. They've composed all the theme tunes for every show on Monocle 24, including this very one. Peter, welcome.
Thank you.
We know you as the, as we have just described, as the man who is responsible for the music on Monocle 24, but how would you describe the sound of Quiet Nights Orchestra?
It's really hard to describe it. You know, we think we're quite quite a modern sound, but we got a lot of influences, and we're looking back to move forward. I think we're such a big group, and we're bringing all our influences to the group sounds and mix them together to do our own thing. I think that's a good.
How did you start off on this musical journey? Because you've taken some unusual turns along the way. Was this did this begin with playing particular instruments that lent themselves to a funk and jazz sort of theme, or is that just your preferred genre to listen to originally?
You know, I play the trombone, and I listen to jazz all my life. And the band actually started as a jazz sextet. And then we brought Sophie, a good friend to me, Sophie Norling, to sing with us. And then it just evolved to this group, the Quiet Nice Orchestra. And we brought all the instruments together, and the sound was... We're actually moving the sound as we speak, you know, evolving everything. So.
How did you find the fact that you were based in Sweden a benefit in terms of the fact that you're jazz musicians? I mean, did you find yourself able to explore jazz music a lot more easily simply because you were based in Scandinavia?
I don't know, actually. Like, you know, Sweden is we got a long tradition of jazz, and I lived in a small town called Sandviken in the northern parts of Sweden, and there was a big tradition of big band, like a Sandviken big band. With all these jazz artists, like this, they play with Georgie Fame from the UK, and I grew up with that. You know, I heard jazz all day, so it was quite easy for me. And I like all kind of music. You know, I'm open to everything. So it's hard to explain, but it's been in my life for such a long time. So.
Well, what about the evolution of that sound? You've got a very distinctive sound, which you kindly lent us here at Monocle 24, of course. Horns are a big part of it. A jazz musician once said to me, horns are like musical anchovies. If you put them in somewhere, they sort of take over. They're very dominant, and they will end up sort of shaping the product that you end up with. How do you feel about horns, and are they the starting point for you?
Yeah, you know... It's quite hard to, when we arrange a song, we, for example, with Sophie, we need to do something like, I spoke to a fan of us when we played live, and they think that the horns were taking over the whole song. And we were taking, and I was listening to that, and I agreed. So we are trying to make the songs more like a producing, like a, you know, like a painting, like everything should be there. And take its place, but nothing should take over, if you understand what I mean.
Peter, let's listen to some of your music choices. Let's begin, I would imagine, in the easiest place to begin, a track from your latest album, Waves, by the Quiet Night Orchestra. We'll hear it in a moment. Tell us a little bit more about it.
Yeah, it's actually written by a drummer called Ottosson, and it's my favourite song on our latest album, Moving. And I think it's really great that in the beginning I was the only one writing the songs and doing everything, but I wanted the band to evolve to everyone to do something, and you can hear that on the latest album. There's more people writing songs, and this is written by our drummer Carl Ottosson.
Let's have a listen. This is Moving.
Troubled mind.
So that is the sound of the album moving. That's the track Waves. It makes me think about jazz and the sort of connotations with that word. In certain places, jazz will be a bit of a bad word in some people's eyes. Funk is a much more sort of acceptable form of popular music, certainly in the circles I mix with in London. Anyway, how is jazz received in Sweden at the moment, and what sort of audience is there for it?
I kind of agree with what you're saying. It's quite the same here in Sweden. You know, when people hear the words jazz, they think of something difficult. But I think it's our responsibility to show people that jazz is just music. You know, it's open for everybody, and you can give it a chance. Just listen to it. You know, I know there's plenty of music, especially in jazz, you will love. You know, it's such a thing in every kind of music. You know, you can't like everything, but there's such great jazz out there. So just keep your eyes open and keep your ears open.
And as a result of that, what venues do you normally end up playing in?
We mostly play at jazz clubs here in Sweden. Actually, they take a lot of time to be accepted for an artist here in Sweden. You're a talent a really long time, but we keep on working, and we're getting closer to these big venues all the time. And we're actually playing a lot more outside of Sweden. We're playing in a lot of great venues in Europe. So.
Let's have another listen to one of the songs you've hand-selected for us this week. This is Nicola Conte. Can you tell us a bit about this one?
Yeah, Nicola Conte, he's a great musician and a DJ from Italy. And I've been inspired by his work for such a long time. And he writes so much great music, and he's a really great DJ playing all this great music. So just listen to it. This is called Jet Sounds. Bye.
That was the Italian DJ, producer, guitarist and bandleader Nicola Conte, and that track was Jet Sounds. It was the choice of Peter Fredrickson, our guest music reviewer on today's review. Peter Fredrickson, of course, from the Quiet Nights Orchestra. Peter, just listening to that, it reminded me an awful lot of the attempt that maybe Dom was referring to a moment ago of the crossover between jazz and funk, which was the acid jazz in the 1990s. What's happened there?
What happened with acid jazz?
Yes.
I don't know, actually. I think that mostly people just bring their own influence into the music. Like, when we write music, I play a lot of music. I play pop from jazz to pop and reggae and everything, you know. And I really enjoy music, so I bring all these influences together. So I think if you listen to the music, you can find influences from everywhere. And that's a really great thing. I like to hear that kind of music when you can hear influences from everywhere. You know, that's what makes music good.
And we can certainly hear lots of South American influences there from an Italian DJ and producer. So, do you get the feeling that at the moment there is a greater sort of there's more fluidity between the genres because of people's accessibility to music now? Do you feel like people are bringing in more than they once did, and musically people aren't as pigeonholed perhaps as they once were?
Yeah, I think you can say that people are more braver this time, because it's such a bigger world than before. You know, people are listening to everything, and people are, I think they are more braver this time than before.
So who should we be listening to coming out of Stockholm?
From Stockholm?
Mm.
I think a really great band coming out this year is actually a band on my own label called Akasatoka. They are releasing a new album in May, and they're really great sounds. And they also from the South American area. They're playing Brazilian rhythms and everything. Really great music between. You can hear the influences between pop and the Brazilian rhythms, like the samba and everything. It's really great music. So keep your eyes open for A Casa Toca.
This, of course, is your final choice of music for today's review. And we must leave it there. Thank you very much indeed, Peter Fredrickson from the Quiet Nights Orchestra. Very regular in this parish in terms of all the music that we hear on Monocle 24.
Yes.
Let's leave this particular item with hearing from A Casa Toca, which is what Peter was talking about there. This is a track called Son Hadara.
Quando você vier me buscar, todo meu coração vou te dar, a vida sois vai se transformar. Você montando num cavalo branco, estou te esperando aqui no castelo, já tá na hora. A gente compra uma casa no campo, os dias cheios de alegria e tanto amor, o sol sempre brilhando no céu. Carro italiano, um jardim com rosas, viagens pra Paris, pra Londres e Roma. Sou sonhadora.
Sou sonhadora.
Continuar a sonha, continuar.
Sou sonhadora.
Continuar a sonha, continuar.
Sou sonhadora.
Continuar a sonha, continuar. Continuar a dormir, sonhadora. Daqui a pouco, pés pequenos no chão. Você possui meu coração. De noite canto cantigas pra vocês. Você brincando com pequeno na neve, um retrato do que a vida deve ser. Sou sonhadora.
Sou sonhadora.
A Casa Toca with Sonadora. Ending that musical section of today's review with our guest Peter Fredrickson from Quiet Nights Orchestra. We're going to move to Copenhagen now, where a month-long festival is kicking off this week. Here's our man Michael Booth to tell us about it.
Kicking off this coming week in Copenhagen is Wonder Cool, the city's annual February festival. Now, despite the event's slightly questionable name, the lineup's actually pretty great, covering everything from music and art to food and fashion. One of the main sub-festivals is Frost, which specialises in staging gigs in unlikely settings, like in the Botanic Gardens or an old shipbuilder's, a strip club or the Zoological Museum. Danish indie rockers Efterklang are performing some of their really interesting new stuff in a gigantic diesel engine hall in the industrial quarter of Suhaun. Recently, they've been recording in a disused Russian mining town on Svalbard. And the Danish singer Peter Sommer, he's going to be playing a secret underground car park.
Og flasker vin og så på en hverdagsaften. Hvis der var noget der.
This being Copenhagen, jazz is also a big part of Wonder Cool. The UK's Get the Blessing, who kind of mix up jazz and funk and rock, are playing too at the rather more conventional jazz house. Also under the umbrella of the Wonder Cool Festival is Copenhagen Fashion Week from the 30th of January to the 3rd of February. And the Danish Architecture Centre is arranging architectural-themed guided walks in the city. Personally, I'm looking forward to the winter edition of Food Festival Copenhagen Cooking. There's going to be lots of stuff about mussels, apparently. This is the best time of year to eat them. Plus, the people behind the excellent Mad Food Camp and Noma are going to be holding food discussions every Monday during the festival, talking about the current issues in the food world. And for those who don't fancy a slice of what Wonder Cool has to offer, Danish pop princess Aura plays Vega on the 9th. And Louisiana Museum of Modern Art's amazing exhibition of early Andy Warhol drawings continues until February the 21st. For Monocle in Copenhagen, I'm Michael Booth.
And that was Michael Booth giving us the best information that he can about what's happening in Copenhagen with a month-long festival on its way. You're with a review here on Monocle 24. Up next, we ask whether we're seeing a reinvention of the rom-com.
Section D is Monocle 24's show about design. Each week we take you on a whistle-stop tour of the people and places making a splash in the world of craft, architecture, graphics, fashion and retail.
How do you explain the value of design? What can we do to make clients and designers work better together?
On the latest episode, we round up the menswear collections in Paris, take the heat of the German construction industry at Bau in Munich. We drop in on the Butter Shoe Museum in Toronto and learn how to make a fragrance in Paris.
I've got my pipette. I've already put in some wood and some musk, and I'm now adding the amber drop by drop.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
It's Saturday, so you must be listening to The Review with Emma Nelson and Dominic Reynolds.
Now, boy meets girl and falls in love. Boy briefly loses girl because of a misunderstanding, but reunites with her in time for a soaring pop song and a tear-jerking crane shot. Welcome to the world of the rom-com, churning out minor variations on a foolproof formula since Harry met Sally in 1989.
Yes! 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 Yes!
So how on earth did it go from that to this?
This may sound strange, but for years I've pretended to be married.
My wife beats me in front of my kids.
No!
I know how wrong it is, but there's no strings attached and nobody gets hurt.
Once we got married, I thought she'd stop hooking.
You need to put this wedding band on a true heart.
That's what it feels like.
Adam Sandler and Jennifer Aniston beating the genre to death there in the 2011 romantic comedy Just Go With It. But what is it about that formula that continues to pull in the punters into the multiplexes and indeed gave arguably a purpose to Jennifer Aniston? Should we be demanding more from the rom-com or should we be killing it off completely? Well, one film that's promising to deliver more is I Give It a Year, a look at what happens in the 12 months after Happily Ever After.
And joining us to discuss this one and the state of the genre in general, I'm delighted to welcome back our critic Jasper Rees from theartsdesk.com. Hello, Jasper. Welcome to The Review.
Thank you very much, Tom.
So, what's this new one is called I Give It a Year.
Yep.
What do you give it? Is it any good?
The thing about the rom-com is it's got to have rom and it's got to have com.
Yes.
And this has rather more comedy than romance, I would say. It's extremely funny.
Well, that's
you
good.
You will laugh your head off watching this film, but you will not leave the cinema weeping into your box of Kleenex because it's not particularly romantic. The idea is that when you join this film at the start, you are, as it were, at the end of the romantic comedy already because the two main characters have married. We've seen in a kind of rapid montage their romance.
So the credits of the regular film have already rolled and this happens after that.
Precisely. That's exactly what happens. And then the character of the female, the sister of the female lead, who's played by Minnie Driver, says, I give it a year at the wedding. And that is what plays out for the rest of the film. You sit there thinking, are they going to make it? Are they going to be able to turn this into a romance? Or are they, as becomes increasingly apparent, going to fall for other people?
Let's have a quick listen to I Give It a Year.
I thought I got it made.
I married a doctor.
First word. Red.
Sick, lazy, stupid, disappointment.
That was 9 months ago. And it's just something in our marriage that hasn't quite gelled.
You realise you've married beneath yourself. You thought it could be someone better looking, better body.
No.
Right, so were there terrible sexual problems?
See, that to me sounds fairly terrible, but maybe it's the soundtrack.
It doesn't help
at all. Would it have worked if it had been billed as a straight comedy?
It's certainly. I mean, if you want to go and see a film that has lots and lots of laughs, then this is a great film to go and see. There are some fantastic performances from wonderful British comedy character actors like Olivia Colman. Plays a very funny and completely dysfunctional marriage guidance counsellor.
Brilliantly watchable all the time.
She's wonderful. Stephen Merchant plays, as it were, himself. He plays the kind of the disastrous best mate who is the worst best man in history.
Right. I have to say, that doesn't fill me with optimism.
Yeah, and Minnie Driver is very funny. And actually, in the kind of male romantic lead, Rafe Spall, who has most recently been seen on a screen in The Life of Pi as the novelist to whom the main character tells his story, is extremely funny. But I just feel you've got to root for these characters, and I didn't root for them in the slightest.
Okay, but you did laugh.
And oh yeah, yeah, like
me,
a drain.
I'm certainly willing to pay for my cinema ticket if it's guaranteed to make me laugh. But
it's a comedy, it's not a romance.
Is the fact that it is much more com than rom indicative of the sort of the shape of the genre and where it's been going? Because we've had this sort of frat boy sort of humour, the sort of the Stiller, Vaughan, Owen Wilson set have been dominating for a few years, and then The Hangover turned up and then spawned Bridesmaids, the sort of female version of that. So is there a journey towards more sort of smutty humour, essentially, and less of the tear-jerking romance?
I guess it depends who's at the helm. If these films are being made by men and trying to lure a young male audience into the multiplex to watch rom-coms, then those are the boxes that they're likely to tick. But the point about rom-com is, because it reached in that film that you cited at the beginning, When Harry Met Sally, and also I would say Sleepless in Seattle, a kind of sort of platonic ideal of the perfect rom-com, in that you did laugh and you cried and you really cared. Ever since then, people have been, filmmakers I can't think of a single rom-com since that heyday which has really ticked those boxes in quite the same way, until actually this year, or rather at the end of last year, Silver Linings Playbook, which I think is a fantastic film.
We'll move on to Silver Linings Playbook in just a moment.
Yeah, okay.
I Give It a Year is a British film.
Yes, it's extremely British.
Do you think, playing on the great Richard Curtis theme of British rom-coms, although I Give It a Year is going to be released in both the UK and Europe this week, do you think it's funnier if you are British and if you see the American rom-coms, the likes of which Dom was just talking about, which leave many viewers cold? Do you think if you were of an international audience, you'd actually enjoy it a bit more?
I don't feel that its Britishness is integral to its comedy. Stephen Merchant with Ricky Gervais has made people laugh all over the world, and it's the same kind of humour, so I don't see that it won't work elsewhere.
On the subject of the Silver Linings Playbook, opinions on the review team seem to differ on this film. I know you clearly love it.
I won't speak to anyone who doesn't love it.
In that case, we're going to have a difficult next 8 minutes. the problem I had with the Silver Linings Playbook is it claimed so much to be reinventing the genre, and I feel like every year there's a film that says, I'm not your regular rom-com, there's 500 Years of Summer the year before, 500 Days of Summer rather, the year before.
Yeah.
And I felt like with Silver Linings Playbook, which is a sort of mental illness romantic comedy, if you will, with people with bipolar disorder getting into a romance, I felt like all of the quirkiness and interestingness in that film was sort of crammed into the first half an hour, and then it descended into sort of a slightly better Aniston Sandler movie towards the end.
No, I disagree. I just disagree. I thought it was extremely moving, and I think that yes, you can, in most romantic comedies, you will probably find yourself laughing at stuff, even though you might recognise that the writing is not brilliant. But usually there are good comic performers in these films. But with Silver Linings Playbook, I just cared. And if you get to the end and you are really rooting for these characters, even though you can see that all the boxes are being ticked about they're delivering plot moments that rom-com needs to deliver. Even if, in spite of those, tropes that you see being trotted out, you still care, you're still rooting for them, I think that's a sign of a good rom-com.
Let's have a listen to it.
What meds are you on?
I used to be on lithium and Seroquel.
I was on Xanax.
You ever take Klonopin?
Klonopin, yeah.
I guess I'm what?
I'm tired, I want to go. Are you going to walk me home or what?
You have poor social skills. You have a problem.
I have a problem? Mm-hmm. You say more inappropriate things than appropriate things.
Doc, she's crazy.
Hey!
Whoa, what the hell?
She knew where I was. She followed me.
Then why don't you run somewhere else?
Calm down, crazy.
Maybe she just needs a friend.
You want to have dinner at this diner?
Pick me up at 7:30.
So how's your job?
I just got fired, actually.
Oh, really? How?
By having sex with everybody in the office.
Everybody?
Now,
and that was, of course, Silver Linings Playbook, described moments ago by Don Reynolds as a mental illness rom-com.
I mean, you put that on the poster if you like. I mean, it reminded me there are actually some funny moments in that.
There are funny moments, and I think that the point about all of these films, I mean, when you reduce them to a trailer, that they are, inevitably, their qualities, their humanity don't come across. And that film, for me, has great humanity, and I hope it does really well at the Oscars.
Well,
next month.
I wanted to talk about that, because historically, the Academy doesn't favour comedies. It doesn't seem to rate them as important and worthy of awards. However, this one has done very well thus far and been nominated in several categories.
It still doesn't stand a chance against the monolith Lincoln and Les Miserables, I fear.
Interestingly, it's directed by somebody who has sort of dramatic chops as well. David O. Russell was nominated several times for The Fighter with Mark Wahlberg a couple of years ago. So he's versatile, this guy.
Yeah, well, I think that just shows what he's brought to the film is drama, and a real sort of a generic rom-com just knows which route to take without really knowing how to fill the film with humanity.
I was just going to ask you about Jennifer Lawrence, nominated for an Academy Award for Best Actress here among all the others who are nominated for Silver Linings Playbook. It reminded me of a quote I will attribute astonishingly to Peter Stringfellow, who once said that a woman cannot be funny and beautiful. Now, do you think that's a particular problem when it comes to a rom-com? And do you think Jennifer Lawrence has managed to negotiate this issue?
Well, I think that says a lot more about Peter Stringfellow than it does about I'm racking my brains. Well, Michelle Ryan, whose seat I have, I wish to claim I've actually sat in.
Meg Ryan.
Meg Ryan, yeah.
Most Michelle Ryan. Michelle Ryan.
My apologies. Meg Ryan. Who knows, I may have sat in Michelle Ryan's seat as well. Meg Ryan's seat in the Lower East Side. She's a very good-looking woman and extremely funny and... I can't believe that's claimed. Jennifer Lawrence is fantastic and also gorgeous.
Well, I mean, the Meg Ryan thing, she's kooky, isn't she? She doesn't tell gags. She's not funny in the way that men are funny. And Jennifer Lawrence in this one too, she's a bit sort of quirky and eccentric, and that's where her funniness comes from.
They're not playing stand-up comedians. They are delivering laughs in a charismatic way that actors who know how to do comedy can do. I don't see what the problem is.
You think there's a big future for Jennifer Lawrence, I suspect.
Absolutely. Yeah, she's a fantastic actress, as anyone who saw Winter's Bone would surely agree.
We have just
no laughs in that.
A tiny moment to talk about Celeste and Jesse Forever.
Well, there's not much to say, really, is there? It's that's a rom-com in which they take the reinvention just ever so slightly too far, in which there are these two people who are getting divorced at the start of the film, and... And yet they're more in love after their divorce than they were before. And it's a film in which there are lots of kind of comic pratfalls, but again, you really just don't care as they move towards full separation.
Jasper Rees, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much, as ever, for coming into the studio. That brings us to the end of our Saturday review. For now, it's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. The show was produced by Katie Bilbao and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our thanks also to our studio manager, Alex Fennell, and to Annabelle Bly.
We're handing back over to Georgina with a weekend edition next, where you can catch our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 stories, guests and features on The Curator. And don't forget to tune in to the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air on Sunday at midday London time with our own Robert Bound and Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck. You've been listening to The Review. It's been with me, Dominic Reynolds.
And me, Emma Nelson. Goodbye.
And have a great weekend.